Session number 3183, reel number 2.
Theodore McAvoy, reel 2. Well, let's begin with the map reading competition then. Tell me a bit about that.
Yes. The Sassoon map reading competition, it was one of these trophies given by Sir Philip Sassoon. He gave a number of trophies, as you probably know, and one of them was for map reading, to encourage people to be able to find a place quickly, get to a place quickly by air. And the competition was run at an appointed Air Force fighting area station. Teams of four from each squadron went along to the station on the appointed day, and equipped with their maps and with little squares of celluloid which we'd made with a grid marked on them which would be superimposed on your map, and circular celluloid protractors marked out with degrees from magnetic north. And when on arrival at the aerodrome, you went into the crew room and were given envelopes which contained four six-figure map references, and you were given the wind speed and direction. And on the word go, the envelopes were opened, and you proceeded to open up your maps and work out where these grid references were by applying your little grid to the map, mark them, join them all up with red lines, and then work out with your course and distance calculator the time it would take you to reach each point at the cruising speed of your aircraft, which was laid down by the command, whatever it might be, 140 miles an hour. We used miles an hour then, of course, not knots. And then you had a stopwatch, which was in your aircraft, and you were allowed a quarter of an hour to work out your courses and times and get into your aircraft and start off. And at that point, a quarter of an hour after you were given the envelopes, you started your stopwatch in the aircraft and took off. And you flew as hard as you damn well could on your track so as to give yourself a few seconds grace to find the place, because you had to drop your message bag with your name and squadron inside it exactly on this point on the ground. And if you flew very fast, it gave you half a minute or so to circle around and make absolutely certain you've got the right point. And then you made a wide turn so that you came in for your message dropping run on the track that you were due to fly for your next leg of your course. You dropped your message bag and pressed your stopwatch twice, once for stop and then for start again, and off you went on the second leg. And the same thing happened each leg of your four legs, and you arrived back over the aerodrome, over the starting line, you should have come up on the right minute on the stopwatch. And the squadrons were marked on the accuracy with which they got their message bags, how many yards from the point and how many minutes from the time. We didn't work in seconds then, we worked in minutes. And the squadron that was, got the most marks won. I can remember with pride we got 100%, so we couldn't have been very far from the message with our message bags from the point or with our timing. But I think the rules were all changed after that to make it more difficult.
Were these points readily identifiable?
No. As far as I remember, it was just a six-figure reference. And there may have been a haystack or road junction to coincide with the point. I can't remember. But if you were very cunning, you could sometimes see a judge, because there were fighting area judges at each point, see a judge lurking with his motor car somewhere near it, and you knew he must be fairly near the point.
And apart from the map reading, what other competitions were there?
There were the great competition really was air firing. That was the most important of the lot, which one did at practice camp at Sutton Bridge. Each squadron went up there for a fortnight, and you fired at first of all at targets on the ground, and then at drogues or flags towed by aircraft in the air. And the marking was done very carefully by the armament staff. And the squadron that scored the highest marks are all the pilots of the squadrons, pilots from each squadron who scored the highest squadron marks, went up and competed for a final, fighting area final, up at Sutton Bridge at the end of the year. And I think two pilots from each squadron fired for their squadron. And that was a very, very exciting and tense competition every year.
How did your squadron get on with that?
We used to do fairly well. I can't remember which squadron in those days won it, but I think in those days Broadhurst and Donaldson were the experts. Always seemed to win every year. And then, of course, there was the bombing. In those days, we used to do bombing with practice bombs, and at practice camp, we used 20-pound Cooper bombs. But the inter-squadron competition was done with practice bombs on an aerodrome, on a target marked out on an aerodrome, and it was done by what was known as converging bombing. Four aircraft converging on the target in succession from courses at right angles to each other. If possible, timing it so that there was as little time as possible between each bomb drop. And I remember on one occasion seeing the shadow of another aircraft cross the target just as I was dropping my bomb, but neither of us saw the other. Eventually the practice was eliminated because there were too many collisions and too many people got killed. But it was a most exciting procedure.
Did you ever see any accidents?
I never saw any, no, but they had some up at Duxford, I know, and during the finals, I think, 1 year, but I didn't happen to see it. But I had some very near escapes, and there was quite a lot of slipstream over the target during the thing, anyway, even if you were doing it properly.
And were there any other kinds of exercises that you took part in as a whole squadron?
Of course, the annual exercises every year. The whole of Fighter Command and Bomber Command, or Fighting Area and Wessex Bombing Area, whatever it was called in those days, took part. And Bomber Command used to come in on raids on London or other places, and Fighting Area squadrons were on patrol to intercept them. And one was told by radio telephony where to go, what patrol line to patrol on. But of course, that was in the days before radar, so one just had to hope one saw the enemy, which one did only occasionally.
How did you actually get on with these exercises in the 1920s when you were with 41 Squadron? What sort of success rate did you have?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what the actual success rate was, but the only thing I can remember is that when we were told to go and patrol any particular line, we very seldom saw any enemy aircraft on that line, but any interceptions we made seemed to me to be purely haphazard.
As a junior officer in one of the squadrons charged with the air defence of Great Britain, how seriously did you feel the weight of that responsibility at that time?
Oh, I don't think at all. The idea, the prospect of war was extremely remote, and it was really an inter-squadron exercise rather than thinking of any potential foe attacking us.
Another important annual event at that time was the Hendon Air Display. Did your squadron take part in those?
Yes, of course. That was a thing that took up a lot of our time. I forgot to mention that. It really took up most of the early summer practicing for the display. Yes, we took part in that first wing evolutions, and another time squadron aerobatics, when we used to loop as a nine in Siskins and roll individually as in flights.
What sort of evolutions in the first case? What sort of evolutions did you do?
Oh, it was very, very straightforward. Squadron formations just formed up and flew in various wing formations. It was very unexciting, but it was just a matter of showing a large number of fighter aircraft in the air at the same time.
Was Hendon an enjoyable time for a fighter pilot?
Oh,
it was a jamboree.
Oh, yes, tremendous. Of course, one was very busy. that one enjoyed it because it was it showed how well your squadron was doing, and there was a certain competitive element in it too.
What was discipline like in general in 41 Squadron?
In 41 Squadron, I'd say it was very good. I can't remember any serious indisciplines.
Was drinking a problem?
Well, it was really. The drinking that went on in those days would never be contemplated at all now. There were no particular rules about it. One could have quite a number of drinks, for instance, at lunchtime and go off and fly afterwards, which for the last, well, ever since the Second World War, one would never have dreamt of drinking anything at lunchtime. And in those days it was normal. And really, occasionally pilots would fly when half tight, but it didn't often lead to anything very serious, but it could have done.
I was amused by what you told me last time about how your eyes were first opened, as it were, when you arrived from Cranwell.
Oh, yes. Well, I remember, I think it's about my first or second day, as I told you, everybody was on leave in the squadron. All the officers were on leave. Anyway, it was a leave period. But after lunch, I was sitting in the flight office, wondering whether to fly or not, when a sergeant pilot appeared and relieved himself on the tarmac and then climbed into an avro and started it up. And when he ran up the engine, it tilted right forward onto its skid. And I thought, well, I don't know, I've never seen an avro run up like that before, but I suppose sergeant pilots do that sort of thing. And then he took off and did a lot of crazy flying. And there again, I thought, well, this is extremely crazy flying. I haven't seen anything quite as crazy as that before, but I suppose that's done in the Air Force. And he finally flew into a barrack block and destroyed the aeroplane, but not himself. But that was my first introduction to undisciplined flying, but I never saw anything like that again.
How much did the general conduct of a squadron depend on the character of the squadron leader?
Oh, very much, very much. We had an excellent squadron leader, and of course we had an excellent squadron, but then everybody says his own squadron is excellent. But I'd say it had a profound effect. Yes.
What were the sort of qualities that were most respected in a squadron leader?
Ability to fly, professional ability. He could lead you and do everything that anybody else in the squadron could do, and probably do better. That was the first thing. And I say that's the main thing, and be able to maintain discipline and be fair and just with people when anything went wrong, and settle disputes between officers. Because very often one had disputes with other officers, and you needed somebody to calm them down and tell them not to behave like schoolgirls, and a squadron leader who could do that was respected.
What sort of things did disputes arise about?
Oh, stupid little things. Quite ridiculous. Somebody misunderstanding something somebody else had said, that kind of thing. But, I don't know, one perhaps took things more seriously in those days, and a sense of humour usually settled these things.
Did you have the same squadron leader throughout your period?
Not entirely. First of all, my CO was Merlis Green, who was the distinguished night fighter pilot of the First War, and then Fred Sowry, who one of the pilots who shot down the Zeppelins during the First War, and he was a magnificent chap. Well, so was Merlis Green, but we all loved Fred Sowry. His son is now an Air Marshal, Sir Frederick Sowry, but old Fred was a great chap. We all loved him. He's a great polo player.
Were the officers in the RAF who'd actually fought in the First World War very much looked up to?
Oh, yes. I think we took them as a matter of course, but undoubtedly their achievements weighed with us, and we sought to emulate them.
Did you talk very much in the squadron about the First World War?
Yes, I think we talked about every aspect of flying. Shop was almost invariably talked, and I don't think any aspect of flying was not covered day and night.
Were there any rules about where you couldn't talk shop?
Yes, one was not allowed, well, one shouldn't have talked shop in the mess, but one always did.
What other sorts of things went on in the mess? Was that the centre of your social life?
Oh, very much, yes. And of course, very few people were married in those days, because one didn't get a marriage allowance until one was 30, so there were distinct financial impediments to marriage, and most of them insuperable. So the mess was quite a lively place. Nearly everybody lived in, and every evening, I was in Norfolk, rather near London. A lot of chaps who could afford it used to go to London, but there was still quite a lot of mess life in the evenings.
What sort of things would you engage in during the evening, that period?
Billiards was a great thing in the evening. There was a billiard table, billiard room with a couple of tables. Cards, a lot of people used to play bridge. And of course there were guest nights when there were rougher games played.
What sort of things went on guest nights?
Oh, high cockalorum was a great thing, where one stood in a row with one's head between the legs of the chap in front of one, formed a long line, and the other team used to run along from behind and do a sort of leapfrog as far along this row of chaps as you could get, and cling on, and then the next chap ran along and did the same. So you had a great pile of fellows on the line of chaps with their heads between the other's legs until either the attacking team fell off or the defending team collapsed under the weight of the attackers. And that could go on quite a long time.
Did anyone get hurt?
Oh, yes, frequently. Yes, arms and legs were broken and so on. But that was all in the game.
Would there be any comeback afterwards if anything...
Oh, no. No, it was all part of the system. It was unfortunate, but unavoidable.
Of course, you didn't, on that particular station, have another squadron there actually to compete against.
No, we didn't. That was, I think it would have been better if we had. The other squadron was a 24th squadron, as the communication flight became. And it wasn't really in the competition because it was only a communication flight. No, we did miss that.
Did you compete between different flights?
Oh, yes, there was the Adams Cup. We used to compete for the Adams Cup, given by Mrs. Adams in memory of her son who was killed while I was there. He unfortunately spun into the deck by his own error. And his mother gave a cup to commemorate him, and we used to compete for it in... radio, flight aerobatics, and air firing.
What was the competition over radio?
Seeing if you could receive the message and act on it. Because in those days, it was very rarely that one received a message transmitted from the ground. One had to tune in extremely accurately, and even sometimes have one's aircraft pointing in the right direction to be able to receive a message at all. And a chap who could receive a message, not only receive it, but act on it, was something of a prize-worthy affair.
How did you get on with that?
Oh, B flight, when I was there, managed to win it, because B flight always liked to win everything.
One of the things you mentioned last time was... a rather different part of the training was actually having to attend court-martials.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that.
Yes, every officer, before he could pass his promotion exam, had to have attended a certain number of court-martials under instruction. I forget how many, but one did travel around a bit attending these court-martials, which one resented rather as a waste of time, not flying, but it was quite entertaining when one got there.
Were there quite a lot of court-martials for you to choose from?
There were quite a lot, yes. I can't remember whether we chose or whether we were sent, but I think we were sent when there was one on. I can remember No, I think I can only remember attending one myself, but I must have attended more.
Can you remember what the case was that you attended?
The case was an officer who had got drunk on the station, and he was being court-martialed for, what was it called, offences against good order and Air Force discipline, I think was the charge, for which he was duly convicted and suffered loss of seniority.
You weren't automatically cashiered then if you were found guilty?
One was cashiered for certain offences, and one of the offences I remember which was punishable by cashiering was passing dud cheques. Nowadays it seems to be quite a minor offence, I think, but in those days it was cashiering and nobody would have dreamt of passing a dud cheque. There's other things too, like of a scandalous nature, but those others were more obvious than today than this one of passing dud cheques would be.
Was money a problem for you as a private officer?
Yes, always, but one never worried about it. One enjoyed the life so much that I never spoke about or worried about money. Always complained about not having any, of course, but it was very enjoyable and was never a subject of worry. Indeed, I remember one was 1930, we had a cut in pay. I forget how much it was, 10%, I think. We grumbled, but accepted it.
Was the general shortage of money that was being felt by the RAF and all services at that time, did that affect you at all in the in your squadron, in what you could do or what equipment you had?
No, it didn't impose any cuts, as far as I remember, in training or equipment. It probably delayed the re-equipment of squadrons, but and probably the expansion, because we were even then starting an expansion or trying to start an expansion.
What posting was planned for you when you were nearing the end of your 3 years at
yes.
Norfolk?
Yes, I was posted as adjutant to HMS Courageous in the Fleet Air Arm, and that would have meant sitting in the bowels of a ship playing with paper and not flying, and I didn't relish the idea of this at all, and I complained bitterly to my CO, Fred Sowry, who said, oh yes, I'll talk to the AOC next time he's here. And next time Popham came round, Fred said, McEvoy's been posted to the Courageous. Do you think we could do anything about it? And Brookham said, oh yes, leave that to me. I'll do something about it. And next time he came, he said, I've managed to fix McEvoy's posting. He's going on the engineering course. So that learnt me a lesson I never forgot. I never complained about a posting after that.
Had you actually come into contact with any of the more senior figures in the RAF while you were in your fighter squadron? Had you seen anything of Trenchard, for instance?
I don't think I had ever seen him while I was there. I think not. Possibly in the distance, but I had never spoken to him then. Yes, I remember now. Trenchard gave his memorable speech to the permanent officers in the Royal Air Force. I was thinking it was later, but it was while I was at Northolt, and he summoned all permanent officers to the cinema at Uxbridge, at the Royal Air Force depot at Uxbridge, and addressed them. And it was about the need to keep the Air Force as one service and not split it into engineering branch and other branches, and to ensure that every general duties officer was really a general duties officer, not just a pilot, but could be an engineer or a signaller or whatnot, or an armament officer. But of course, the Air Force eventually did split into branches, armament, engineering, signals and so on. But his plea was to keep it as one service.
What impression did he make on you as a speaker?
Oh, a very good impression. He was forthright and didn't mince his words. And I can remember the occasion well, I very rarely remember anything that's been said to me in the past, but I do remember that.
Did you agree with what he said at the time, the officers?
I can't remember whether I agreed that it didn't, the subject matter of it didn't affect me much, because I was a pilot and wasn't thinking of anything else really than being a pilot. But I would rather have remained a pilot than have become a specialist. But so really, I suppose I wouldn't have agreed with him. I would rather have had purely pilot jobs and left engineering to some other branch.
Possibly that's why he felt that the speech he gave you was necessary.
It may be, may well be, yes.
What then did this engineering course that you were sent on at Henlow consist of?
Well, it was as much engineering knowledge and experience as could be packed into 2 years, theoretical and practical. And I suppose, really, it was a very good course. It certainly gave one a good outline of all the various engineering processes, workshop processes, engineering processes, a lot of visits to engineering firms and so on all over the country. But I was never very interested in it as a subject. So the people who were really interested studied calculus and went on to Cambridge and took a degree, mechanical sciences tripos. But I was never as interested in it as to really try hard about that. And eventually, although I did one engineering job, I eventually had my E qualification taken away from me as being unsuitable for employment on engineering duties.
When did that actually happen?
Oh, I can't remember now whether it was... I think it was after the war, but I don't know. It may have been just before the war. But I remember hailing this with great delight. It was a letter of... intended to imply displeasure, I think, but I was delighted to get it.
Did you have any opportunities to fly while you were at Henlow?
Henlow, yes, we did. We had a communication flight there, and it wasn't taken very much, wasn't made very much use of.